You are listening to the Managing Violence Podcast, the internet's leading podcast on all things self-defense, personal safety, and violence management. I'm your host, Joe Saunders. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Managing Violence Podcast for Season 6. Thank you so much for joining us. I am pumped to be back for Season 6. We had a quick 3-week break. It was long enough for me to feel like I was missing something in my life if I did not get back to dropping these episodes. And what a way to start. We are joined by martial arts legend, pioneer, ahead of his time, visionary, Sifu Paul Vunak. He has been the instructor behind some of the guests that we've already had on over the past 5 seasons, and certainly one of the first people I ever saw talking about real reality and studying it and training for reality, not just giving it lip service. Paul Vunak was well ahead of his time in the 80s and the 90s, and he's probably still ahead of his time right now. If you want to know what it's like to accidentally become a close personal friend and student of Guru Dan Inosanto, or a close personal friend and student of Hicks and Gracie, or how you even manufacture that kind of luck, and then to develop your own legacy and to be mentioned in the same kind of conversations as an equal, well, this conversation is worthwhile. Sifu Paul Vunak, a legend. It was a tremendous honor to spend this time with him, and I hope you enjoy this conversation. Welcome back for Season 6. We are just getting started. Here it is, Sifu Paul Vunak. All right, I'm joined here on the Managing Violence Podcast, first episode of Season 6 with Sifu Paul Vunak. The legend himself has been referenced by many guests previously, and we have managed to get Paul on the line. Thanks for making the time to join us. It's a tremendous honor.
Like I say, my buddy, it's my honor.
I was planning for this show, and I was looking back through your back catalog of titles and the articles I read on you over the years. I think so. As a young martial artist, I first became aware of you in the 90s through Black Belt magazine. And then I think I got some of your VHS tapes either towards the end of the 90s or early 2000s, and then DVDs since then and streaming services. You've been almost like the soundtrack to my martial arts journey. So it was hard for me to figure out, like, what do we actually want to talk about? So I guess probably the first question I have for you, Paul, is how did all this get started? I mean, you've been so far ahead of your time for so long. There's so much that we want to unpack, but what was the origin? How did you end up in martial arts, and what did that look like?
Well, something I did as a child was kind of what I've always been into. And when my parents moved to California, I did some stuff with Taekwondo, but then I just ended up much more comfortable in BKF. It's called Black Karate Federation. And so I spent the rest of my time there doing Kenpo Karate. And I eventually ended up teaching at that school. And then I got the brainy idea as a 17-year-old, I'm going to close down the kids' class. I don't enjoy teaching all these kids. I'd rather teach guys how to fight. And about a month later, my school closed.
That's an unfortunate problem with closing down the kids' program.
Yeah, I learned a few lessons early with that world. And fortunately, I had Dan Inosanto, and the Kali Academy was about 5 miles away. I had always heard of them. So I just wandered in there. And that was actually, that was November 22nd of 1976. And I just kind of became wallpaper from then on out at the place.
Wow. So 1976, you wandered into Kali. I can't imagine there was a lot of people doing Kali or Filipino martial arts in 1976 in the U.S.
Well, you know, you had mentioned I was ahead of my time. I was a bumbling teenager that stepped into the right school at the right time, and I had the right teacher at the end of the day. And Dan and I got very close, and in those days, he was traveling the world, kind of, I guess the best word is edifying folks. Everybody was very stuck into horse stances and their hands on their hips. So over the years, you know, he had a whole litany of schools all over the world that he went to do seminars. People weren't really doing seminars then. You know, this was kind of new. That was almost unheard of. And he would kind of open folks' folks' eyes in the world of, say, kickboxing or collie or whatever. And over the years, I watched him go from one subject to another, kind of opening people's eyes up. And I was just there for the ride.
Yeah. Did you always just sort of tag along with Guru Inosanto in terms of your development, or did you train elsewhere at the same time? How did that work for you?
For a while, for the first year there, I was still doing some training at my other school while we were in the process of closing it. But no, pretty much when I became a Dan Inosanto disciple, from 76 until 83, and the only other art I got involved with was Savat, and Dan introduced me to that fella, and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And we integrated those into the Kali Academy. So it was all a part of the same, agenda, if you will.
Yeah, you're known, or at least credited as being one of the first JKD guys to bring in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. When did that happen, and what was your thought process? I mean, when you, I believe it was through Horian, was that correct?
Yeah. Again, dumb luck. You know, first I bump into Dan Inosanto, and I'm getting the greatest stuff on your feet on planet Earth. And then 5 miles from our school lived Horian, and they hadn't, you know, they were struggling getting their school off the ground and getting their art off the ground. And I became a student of his in his garage.
Wow. Is this mid 80s?
Oh, no. Yeah. We're in the mid 80s now. Yes.
Yeah. Wow. talk about how to accidentally find the best instructors in the world.
Yeah. I would love to tell you how I scoured the earth with this ingenious game plan. You know, but like I say, I bumped into the right people at the right time.
Yeah, but you know what? There's a lot of people that bump into those people and don't recognize the genius and do a week and never come back. So you've got to give yourself some credit for at least recognizing that you had something special. What was the pushback? I mean, early 80s, introducing something like grappling into martial arts when it wasn't mainstream. How was that kind of taken? I mean, I guess you're in a very progressive environment with the Inosanto Academy, very open-minded, and I guess with Guru Dan traveling the world, he's meeting all sorts of people and getting different sorts of influences in his style all the time anyway. But how did that integration happen?
Well, I first went down to Horian's garage, and I came back and I told Dan, he goes, how'd it go? And I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but I said, I feel like I'd just been raped. I mean, I need to go home and take a shower. I've never, ever, I mean, I don't know what to say, Dan. He goes, you know, I told you, you got to stay off the ground, Paul, because, you know, the bigger guy will always be on top, and you can't win a fight on the ground from the bottom. And I said, but Sifu, they have this thing called the guard, and they actually beat you from the bottom. And he looked at me like I just asked him to worship the devil. He's like, what? You know, about a couple months later, I convinced him to bring Horian, I think it was Horian or Hoist, to the school to do a demo. And we had all the JKD guys there, and they were doing their normal demo. And I could see the look in the guys' faces. And I'm this teenager, and these were these 30-year-old guys, and they're kind of rolling their eyes. And I walked up to Horian and I said, hey, Horian, let's not do this. Let's just go ahead and do what you do best. Spar with everybody. So we took one guy at a time. They started from their knees, and it sounded like a Santana. The percussion was a tap, 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 tap. And you know, Horian went completely through the whole school, and he beat most of the people on his back, kind of to show, you know, that position, because that was unheard of. And Dan looked at me and he said, this is different.
Because I know JKD already had some grappling, like people like Larry Hartzell with a very sort of catch-as-catch-can influence, but I guess the guard was a new concept.
Well, you see, Larry, who was a million times better than me at grappling, and he was the consummate person of why you don't want to go to the ground, because his strength was enormous. He'd pick you up, take you on the ground, and always end up on top. So while he did have this grappling association, I didn't really get involved just because of my intrinsic knowledge that I was going to get my ass kicked trying. And then that guard position came along. And if you remember, you know, Hoyce's first, I don't know, 10 fights, when he was fighting people 80 pounds heavier than him, well, physics will have that he's going to go to the ground. That's where he wants to go. The big guy will end up on top. You pull that position, the guard, and then you go from there. And that's how he won his fights.
Yeah, and I think that that created this amazing narrative around Brazilian jiu-jitsu for the little man and so on. I think that that was instrumental to the success of Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. I think it's been mentioned before that if it had been Hickson instead of Hoyce, who looked bigger and more athletic, and if he'd won from being on top or taking the back or something like that, it just wouldn't have been as effective a marketing tool as the skinny kid that looks like he was losing and all of a sudden beats everybody. So it played out well.
That's an interesting point. I never thought of it, but I mean, I watched this skinny kid. He and I used to play foosball in his backyard and go to Palm Springs with our girlfriends. And I mean, it was just, and all of a sudden this kid got thrown in the pit of the lions. You know, and I watched him come out with my worst nightmare, chemo. I mean, this enormous Samoan, and I'm sitting there going, dear God, you know. Yeah, I watched the metamorphosis occur literally overnight. That boy turned into a man.
Yeah, and a man who carved himself the ability to teach seminars around the world for as long as he wants to.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
It's a good couple of years. Paul, let's go back to your story a little bit. So you're training under Dan, and at some point you get recognized as an instructor in your own right, because I start seeing articles popping up about you. How did your profile grow? Like, what was it that led to you sort of stepping out of the shadows, I guess?
Well, Dan actually was the instigator of his top few guys kind of going, in addition to being with him, having their own identity, if you will. Richard Bustelo, his, I don't have a better word than identity, was a boxer, you know, and when people came to our Kali Academy, you know, everybody sent, you know, everybody to Richard if they wanted boxing. And Teddy Lukai was our master with weapons. He was just amazing. And he would go that direction. And so I guess whenever folks wanted like more hardcore stuff, Dan led them to me. So I had, he built my first 20 people. And then he said I should come up with a name. And that's when I came up with Progressive Fighting System.
Very good. One of the things that really stood out for me when I first saw your material, firstly, I mean, the Black Belt magazine articles that I saw as a very young martial artist when I was in my teens, I really liked that you were talking about reality and reality being different from martial arts and different from sport fighting, even as we knew it then, talking about kickboxing and so on. But when I watched the VHS tapes, the DVDs later on, you were the first, I guess, quote-unquote traditional martial artist, although I probably shouldn't use that term, but compared to, you know, the MMA instructionals, you were the first guy that was teaching street fighting or martial arts that actually moved like a fighter. Like, I could tell from your footwork, from your movement, and I guess that's the boxing influence on from JKD. Is that correct?
Contemporary Jeet Kune Do, we always equated ourselves, our stand-up game was always kickboxing. Now, not Thai boxing, but kickboxing. Whereas prior to that, in original Jeet Kune Do, it was more of a karate base. And then beyond contemporary Jeet Kune Do to what I'm doing now, Jeet Kune Do concepts to what I'm doing now, contemporary Jeet Kune Do. And now we're kind of equating ourselves to MMA. So I guess to answer your question, back in those days, It was really good to emulate the boxers and the kickboxers and, you know, the Bill Wallaces of the world. That's what kind of where we were at.
Yeah, I'm also interested in your you're the first person I heard talk about Dumok or Filipino grappling. Can you talk us through that sort of process of where that came from and the applications that you found for that?
Well, Dumog, like everything standing up, Dan taught me. And it's an art by which you use the body's choke points to move him. You'll have leverage to move this person from point A to point B. If you could imagine grabbing under the elbow, like mom used to grab the kids, they grab you up under the elbow and move you. You know, grabbing the neck and twisting it in different directions. So when you combine all that together, and it can go to the ground too, it's a unique art.
I found it very interesting when I first started diving into it a little bit, because I'm predominantly a judo guy, or wrestling and judo were my foundation. And when I started getting into the, I guess, quote unquote, reality-based world, I started looking at how do you adapt some of the things I like doing with a gi to a no-gi environment. And you've got the wrestling grips and so on that you can use for a lot of things. But I got fascinated with this idea of the skin jacket, finding the pockets in the skin and the different grips that you can use to maneuver someone or to create leverage. And Dubog was really fascinating for that, like using the face and using the jaw and using kind of mauling techniques to destabilize and to destroy balance, and then use that to set up throws and takedowns. So I really enjoyed finding that and sort of opening my eyes to what I started calling dirty judo.
I like it, dirty judo. I remember who was that saying, dirty boxing? Randy Couture.
Yeah,
I don't know if you remember. He kind of popularized that term, dirty boxing. And right after he did, all my guys said, yeah, I guess what we're doing is filthy MMA. Eyes and biting.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? That's the thing. Like, I think these two worlds are unnecessarily polarized, where it's like, well, if you want to do MMA, then you go and do sport MMA. If you want to learn how to defend yourself, you go and learn whatever reality-based self-defense system is advertising on Facebook that week. And it's like one side is all about groin kicks and eye gouges, and the other side's all about sport fighting. But the truth is in the middle. I don't think learning how to kick someone in the balls or learning how to gouge someone's eyes, if you don't have a delivery system of actual skills that enable you to fight and get into good positions and control distance and range and generate power, if you don't have those fundamentals, then a couple of little tricks about, you know, vulnerable points aren't going to help you a great deal if you end up in a real situation. And I think vice versa, I think it's great for the sporting grapplers to be aware of where they might be vulnerable.
Yeah, never a wiser word has been said. That is one of the most difficult things that I've been trying to convey to people since the late 70s. There is no quote unquote dirty move that you can do to somebody if you don't know how to kickbox. Okay? All your poking of the eyes and kicking of the balls or even headbutting or anything you think is a dirty move that you're going to do in lieu of learning how to kickbox ain't gonna work. All that shit will get you 50 cents and that'll get you a cup of coffee, okay? And the same thing with the ground. Everybody talks about biting. Does it work? Does it not work? Yeah, I guess over the last 20 years it got popularized. But for the first 10 years that I promulgated Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and that was from like 83 to 93, and there hadn't even been the first real UFC yet, everybody and their mother said to me, I will bite you. I will poke your eyes. Even my own students are going, Sifu, you really want to go to the ground? Aren't you worried about the bite? And what I learned was that does not work. You think you're going to bite somebody or poke their eyes and not know the art? What ends up happening is, you know, you tackle them to the ground, hold cross side till they wiggle a little bit. You mount them like a horse. Well, you mount them. And
feel free. We can put an explicit rating on this. Feel free to say what you want.
I'll edit myself. And it's just you have the way, and the bite never presents itself. So my whole ethos was, you know, I will beat that bite. And then one day I'm driving Hickson to the airport. He calls me up. I got to go fight Takata. Hurry up. Come pick me up. And I'm driving him off to the airport. And I say, hey, Hicks, when you get him on the ground, are you going to punch him or are you going to go straight jiu-jitsu? And he says, well, I will punch him if I can punch him uninterrupted. And I'm like, I have no idea what the heck you're talking about. So after I pick him up and he beats Takata, we take him. We're back to the gym working out. And I go, what do you mean when you say uninterrupted? And then he mounts me and then says, stop me from punching you. Then he pulls guard and flips a triangle and he's slapping my face. When stop me from slapping you. And then, so he gets in all these positions where I see what he means. You're not able to stop this guy because of the position you're in. Okay. And that's what he means by uninterrupted. And I thought that was really cool. Then I'm driving home and the biggest revelation of my life hit. Oh my God, what if you bit somebody uninterrupted from all of the Brazilian jiu-jitsu postures? Mm-hmm. And that became the single biggest revelation of my life for being able to win a situation that's not just a regular street fight. You don't do crazy shit like that against some regular fighter. I mean, that's a ridiculous violence. But if you have to defend your family, that was the biggest thing I learned, was putting the jiu-jitsu with the Kina Muay, that blend.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, that's you're the first guy I ever saw that talked about the technique of biting. Like I never thought about biting as something that required study. And then I saw a DVD of you talking about the difference between nibbling and chewing, and I was like, man, that's actually really interesting. Why haven't we studied that further?
The funny thing is this: when I was doing jiu-jitsu, everybody said, "Why go to the ground? Anybody can wrestle." Okay.
Yeah, right.
Okay. And then the biting is okay. Biting doesn't work, and I agree. If you try to bite somebody, and you're going up against a real wrestler, it won't work. So I agree with that anyway. But aside from that, biting doesn't work because you don't know how to do it well. It is one of the most complicated martial arts that I teach is Kina Muay Thai. If you think about it, the first thing you have to do is you have to get to the ground with this person and you have to establish some sort of posture. Now, they're going to assumingly be attacking you in their jiu-jitsu. Let's assume you're fighting a black belt. You got to defend arm locks and chokes and mounts. And this whole panoply of shit that's happening to you, where do you get your bite? So you have to have the jiu-jitsu game down pat. And then when you get that baby down, at least, at very least, have it up to a purple belt. And then when you start integrating your uninterrupted bites, then you find out where to press and how to hold. And then at the very last second, when you know you got this guy pinned and your cheek is pinned to his cheek and you're just where you want to be mounted, then you go for the bite. And if you do it improper, the guy's just going to scream and it's not going to work. You've escalated the violence of the fight. You have to know how to remove the ear. I mean, this is like if you had a gun, you wouldn't bite anybody, you wouldn't shoot. Okay, this is for life or death situation.
Yeah, it's it's something that Richard Dimitri first exposed me to, is the idea that you can actually bite just to elicit a flinch. It doesn't have to be destructive. Most people will move if they're getting bitten. most people are going to react in some way if they feel someone's teeth get stuck into them.
Well, that's how we train for real. What we do is we put mouthpieces on, and then exactly like if I were to put a choke on you and it would get unbearable and you tap, or an arm lock, yeah, you defend, nope, can't do it, and you tap, we bite. And if you secure a bite on the ear and you tap and you're feeling, you're like, nah, I can get out, and you're feeling this bite because it's, the guy's got a mouthpiece on, and then you go, damn, you got me, and you tap, it's too much. Yeah. So exactly the way you defend Kina Muay Thai and jiu-jitsu is the same way. You got to be able to train it for real.
Yeah, that's fascinating, really fascinating. One thing I always liked about your style is that you really have every range covered. I'm sure you probably feel as an individual, as a martial artist, that you have areas that are stronger than others. But I mean, I've seen you teach at a high level, from the extreme close quarter standing up range to ground to punching, kicking, sticks, projectiles even. I mean, you've really got every single range covered. And also the psychology of real conflict. Was that something that you set out to achieve early on, or was it, again, another instance of dumb luck where you just kind of found the right people and put together a game accidentally?
Actually, I think we could say alcohol helped that one. Okay. Because and that one I kind of got my own self. The 4 years that I spent in a very hardcore military town in the 80s, and all of our Navy SEALs would kind of be on one end and a bunch of bikers on the other. These were not librarians arguing over the Dewey Decimal System. You know, these were real fighters. And every single night, the fight would break out. And nobody had honor. There's no such thing as honor. Nobody rolls their sleeves up and says, let's go outside. The first thing everybody does is their visceral response is to grab something. And usually it was glass, and you would hear all this glass breaking. So if I told somebody I was in 200 fights, they go, what in God's name is wrong with you? But in the 4 years I was there, you know, it's kind of like that's what everybody did. And I'm not saying there isn't anything wrong with me, but at the end of the day, all the stuff we would do, it would always be mass attack and weapons. There was no such thing as one-on-one. That is a sport fight, and you should be able to win your one-on-one match with jiu-jitsu and your Thai boxing. You shouldn't have to go into anything what I call asymmetrical, not needed. Only when you get into a life or death violent situation, when you've got bikers with bottles and a bite might get you out of the restroom to run out of there or something, you know, then you're morally justified. And the fights I've been in, you know, there is no one range. Because you're changing ranges in perpetuity. It never ends. You stand up, you go down, a sticks in your hand, then a bottle. And your ability to flow from thing to thing is the single most important dynamic to win that kind of an encounter. And those are 85% out of 100 fights is a combination of mass attack and weapons.
Yeah, it's so true what you say, the ability to flow between ranges. And I think it's that's something that you don't necessarily learn unless you've been in real violence. I think it's very easy to sort of go, well, today's lesson, we're going to be doing grappling, or in this class, this is our grappling class, and in this class, this is our wrestling class, and in this class, this is our kickboxing class. And you only really integrate if you want to be an MMA fighter. Even like I know a lot of MMA fighters that, at least up until recent years, there wasn't a lot of training on integration. It was separate classes, and you can see guys even in the UFC that it was almost like there was a pause where they had to. It was almost like having to change the vinyl on the record player to put a new track on to go from grappling to striking. and it was like a syncing issue. But the ability to flow and be equally comfortable in both, even in sport fighting, we've seen there are some fighters who are just brilliant at that transition, and it made them so dangerous. And it's really interesting. So I noticed that early on, again, watching your early material, that you were already doing that. And it makes a lot of sense that you developed that out of an understanding of what real violence looks like and having to adapt and fill in those beats, I guess, in between.
I like the way you said that, really eloquent, understanding what real violence looks like and fill in those beats in between. That I appreciate the kind words. Let me translate that. I've gotten my ass kicked 1,000 times. And every time I go, well, that won't work. We won't do that again. Well, that won't work. We won't do that again. And throughout the time of doing that, that's what I teach. I teach stuff not because I think it, I teach it because I know it works. Otherwise, Yeah, when people ask me, you know, oh, Sifu, help me with guns. Do you want a 9mm or do you want a 45? I'm like, bro, I just figured out if you stick your finger in the barrel, it will not blow up the guy on the other side like on the cartoons. You want to learn guns from me? Yeah, you know, so I hate teaching stuff. If I don't know it, I will pass it on. So a lot of the stuff we're talking about, combat and raw street fighting, that comes from losses, you know, and then an experience from that world. Yeah,
I've seen a lot of people market themselves as undefeated in 600 street fights. It's like, well, firstly, if you had 600 street fights, you probably need to reevaluate your personality. Or your risk mitigation strategies if you're living in an area where you're getting into fights every time you leave the house. And secondly, if you won all those street fights, chances are you were just sucker punching grannies. You like, if you get into that many fights and you didn't lose one, then chances are you were stacking the odds in your favor and possibly not learning anything in the process. So I appreciate your candor about the percentage of fights where you got your ass kicked.
My all-time favorite fighter as far as, somebody that can fight, that's what my biggest criteria is, being able to fight outside of your weight class. And especially if you don't get to use asymmetrical violence, it's got to be an amazing feat. And if you remember BJ Penn.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the guy went from lightweight and he fought Machida.
Yeah, okay. At light heavyweight.
Light heavyweight. You know, the guy was just all over the place. And when you look at his fight record, it doesn't look amazingly, you know, it's like, oh, he's got like 10 losses or this or that. Dear God, what he accomplished. You know, Anderson Silva said he is the best fighter I've ever seen. Okay. Yeah, you know, and good old BJ.
And BJ was one of my early favorites because he was a guy that actually flowed really well between ranges. And I think drawing a parallel to what you just said, BJ grew up scrapping. Like that was his brand, right? Just scrap. I think that. It was nothing for him to transition from punching to grappling, because grappling was obviously where he was most comfortable, but he was equally comfortable going toe to toe because that's how he grew up. Yeah. That was like a Saturday night for him. His transitions were just amazing. And you can never feel safe, especially that second run he had where he fought like Shirk and Sanchez. You can never feel safe with BJ because he could knock you out on the feet. He could choke you as you're shooting. He could wrap you up on the ground. Okay, there was nowhere that was safe when fighting BJ.
Yeah, in a very Bruce Lee-esque kind of way, many criteria, as I do air quotes here, that you need for putting together a world-class fighter came together for him, because there was natural God-given talent, okay? Then it jived with a martial art that was functional, which also jived with growing up on the islands in BJ's case, and Bruce had many parallels to this, okay? And when you put this perfect combination of things together like that, you have this confluence of things that make a perfect fighter, you know? And BJ and Bruce both had, had Bruce have lived, I absolutely guarantee you he would have fallen in love with jiu-jitsu. I just find it so ironic because he and Dan scoured planet Earth. They went through every martial art, the most sublime art you could imagine, to find nuanced things to help them. But somehow Brazil was passed up, and oh, it would be like a Christmas gift to Bruce if he could ever see jiu-jitsu.
yeah. I know he had some time with Judo Jean LaBelle, who's another another hero of mine and someone I was very fortunate to meet and train with. But I from what I understand, their time together was limited.
Yes, Judo Jean. I love him.
What a legend of a man.
Oh, gosh, yes. He used to come to our school all the time. That was the first time I got choked out by him. He had his pink gi on and the whole thing, and he had the comedy thing going at the same time, and he's a trip.
Yeah, look, when I met Gene, he was 82 already, Still teaching class at Hyastan. I was, I popped in. I was in town just briefly, and I had a Monday night, and I was free in LA. And I thought, I've got to go out to North Hollywood, and I've got to meet Gene. And sure enough, he was there, and he was teaching class, and still mentally as sharp as ever. Like he was bantering with me, and gave me a copy of his book, and yeah, fantastic human being, and just I guess what would you call him? Is an envoy of the martial arts. Like if you want anyone to fall in love with martial arts, you go get him to talk to Gene LaBelle, and you'll come away falling in love.
I couldn't agree with you more. I just have to share this one. I was at a tournament with Gene, and he's sitting down with Dan and a few other people, and he's discussing very, very eloquent nuance of judo and comparison, and it sounds like this. This very articulate professor, okay? And then, bam, within 2 seconds, he looks up, and there's this fella that used to run Panther Productions named Joe Jennings. And he goes, "Say, Joe, the next time you," and I won't say the F word, and then me, okay, "well, please give me a kiss." And then he comes right back down to the conversation and continues this beautiful talk. And I was just like, oh my God, this multi, he was just, I loved him. I loved
yeah.
him.
Yeah. And that's what happens when you have an amazing martial artist who grows up in the pro wrestling and boxing world. Like you get a multifaceted human being. Coming back to, to your early training, I'm really curious, what did your training schedule look like? How much time were you spending on the mats? Because from what I gather, you pretty much live there.
You're referring when I first met to John.
Sorry, we're back in the 80s. So how often were you training?
Well, I always thought it was better to usurp the normal relationship between a student and a teacher and get straight to the meat. Whenever I would work with Dan, he would be teaching some move in class. And because I had the luxury of being up his kula 24 hours a day, following him everywhere you could imagine, going to seminars with him, I would go up to him and say, "Hey, Sifu, please, I don't want to learn this stuff. Show me what you did to that guy when we were in the alley in Aspen, Colorado. I know you remember what I'm talking about." And he'll roll his eyes, "Oh, come here." You know? And I could do that because I had a special relationship, you know, and had I have not, you know, fostered that special relationship, that would have just been rude and disrespectful and presumptuous. And I had the same thing with Hickson, you know. Hickson, I don't want to learn this collar choke. Man, what about, remember that Japanese guy who hooked your face? What was that move you did to get out, you know? And this is kind of like, so when I learned jujitsu in the beginning, I felt it was better to babysit the kids, and Hoist and I became just incredible friends, and Horian, and I put them on the cover of my magazine I had back then, and we became this big family for many, many years, all of them, Hoist and Horian and Hoyler. And then eventually I had the same sort of relationship with Hickson.
I guess you're so incredibly blessed with the quality of mentors that you had. But I think the whole concept of mentorship, or that, you know, in the Japanese martial arts, you're called the uchideshi, or the live-in student, I think, We lose that so much in the modern era, where it's like everyone just wants to pay their dues and show up 3 days a week, and you know they'll eventually progress. And I think it's we've lost so much in that attitude of service. Like I said, babysitting the kids, washing the car, like the Mr. Miyagi stuff. It's become so cliche, but that there's so much development that happens in those incidental conversations, and in those those little observations that you have. I'll never forget. I don't know if you've ever met Richard Norton. Richard is an Australian martial artist and works quite a lot in Hollywood as a stuntman and stunt coordinator. Has been a martial artist forever. I think he's now a ninth degree black belt in Zendo Kai. But I'll never forget. I was attending a seminar with Richard, and he was flying in from LA to Brisbane, Australia. And he was literally getting off the plane and going to teach the seminar, right? So it's a 14-15 hour flight, and his flight had been delayed. And we're all standing around waiting for the seminar to start. And we didn't realize that there was literally no gap between his travel time and starting the seminar. So I think originally he was supposed to have a 2-hour break, and then the flight was delayed like 3 hours. So we're all standing around waiting for the seminar. We're waiting for Richard to arrive. And eventually a cab pulls up. And Richard hops out, and man, he looks like death. Like he looks like a guy who's been in transit for 20 hours. And I'm looking at this going, and I think he was already like 59, 60 years old, something like that at the time. And I'm looking at this older guy who looks like he's been through hell. I'm like, this is probably not going to be a great seminar tonight. Like I'm probably not going to get the A game tonight. And he smiled and politely greeted everyone and just excused himself to go get changed. And he came out, and he's wearing his gi. He always wore a red gi top. He came out wearing this red gi, and he was a different human being. Like he literally, it was like he'd got in a 14-hour sleep in the 15 minutes he was in the changing room. And he came out, and he was gliding, and he was like, I was trying to figure out what it was about the way he moved that was mesmerizing. And what I realized is that it was like everything he was doing, every tiny muscle in his body was firing at the exact right microsecond to make the movement as effortless as possible. And it was like just watching him walk across the room was like watching an artist paint. And I was like, man, this is incredible. But it was that observation. Like, I don't remember anything he taught in that seminar, but it was that observation of movement and life and the ability to transition from being wiped out and half dead to alive and full of energy and firing on full cylinders. That I took a lot away from just that observation before the seminar even started. And I guess that's a long-winded way of saying that what you said about just following around Guru and Asanto and Hickson to see what life is like for them and to pick their brain is so useful.
No, actually, it was very eloquent, because the way it is, in my opinion, when you watch a teacher, the first thing you're going to do is see what he's teaching. So you're going to watch his hands. And then once you've been there a while and you know what the Pak Sal and the Lop Sal looks like, you're going to watch his body twist a little bit. And the guys that are even more elevated are going to be watching his feet. They're not even going to be watching the trap. They've seen it for 20 years, but they're noticing the slight shift of the body. One of the things that I recall about Dan is he would be out in long range and he would be talking while he'd be moving, and he seemed so relaxed. But the nanosecond he would do some destruction, some grunting, and he would come into trapping range, his eyes would roll back in his head, spit would come flying out of his mouth, and he turned into this other thing, okay? And then if he popped back out in long range, he relaxed again. And I kind of broached that subject with him. And I could tell he appreciated somebody noticed the nuance. And he discussed that trapping range is when you got to let it go. There is no, that's so you explode, you recover, or you engage killer instinct, and then you engage relaxation. And that little things like that, then the rest of my life, I worked being explosive in trapping range because of that day. It just made sense.
And I think there's something to be said for the mental rationing of that intensity and that aggression. I don't think you can hold on to it for an extended period of time. I think you need to focus it into those, like that laser-like aggression just for this couple of seconds that it's required, and then to be able to detach from it. I think that's super important. And we see this, I know you've been around the fight game and I've been around a little bit as well. Like sometimes the worst behaved fighters are the ones who won really quickly because they got all this adrenaline and rage built up going for a 15, 20 minute or 25 minute fight. And then they win in a minute and they come back to the dressing room and they've got all this angst built up that hasn't had an outlet yet. I've had to put fighters through pad work afterwards just to get the rest of it out of them. I think being able to ration that is really important.
The deep end is everything. When I talk about a fight, I'm always talking about I always assume a fight, I'm talking about mass attack and weapons. Most people I'm thinking when I say fight, they're thinking some sort of one-on-one thing. Okay. Yeah. And one-on-one, matches you rarely get in the deep end. Okay. I mean, now two professional fighters, two MMA guys, and they get to round 3 and then round 4 and they're both tired, and then one guy does a double leg, and oh, he's dragging him in the deep end. But that one-on-one, that's really difficult. The only deep ends I've been in on one-on-one has been when I ended up on the ground, and I'm in the guard, and there's a big dude pounding me, and I'm stuck there for a long time. Mm-hmm. And before jiu-jitsu, I would have lost every single one of those matches. Big wrestlers, 100 pounds heavier than me. You know, and I managed to win, say, 80% of them. And the idea is just doing it out of the deep end. It took 20 minutes, you know. It took a half an hour.
Yeah, I think not to focus the conversation too much on sport fighting, but I think that's one of the things I loved about the early MMA without the time limits. Is that you could? There was no respite. No one was coming to save you at the 5-minute hooter. You know, like you were stuck in a bad position. You were stuck there, and the referees weren't quite as quick to call the fight either. So you had to find a way out, or you were going to take a beating.
Absolutely, those were different days. Definitely different days. People are adjusting to all the nuance. You know, when the rules happened, all jiu-jitsu got hit harder than anybody else. Okay. How many times do they say, okay, you've been standing a lot, time to go on the ground,
okay? Exactly.
You know, think about that. But they'll say, yeah, you've been in this posture a long time. We're not very excited. Yeah, let's get you up. You know, I mean, what? You're going to do what? You know, but that those are the rules. Got to abide by them.
Yeah, and also just the ability to survive until the end of the round. Like, you know, your corner man saying, oh, you got a minute 30 left. Like, you can just survive. Like, that's fine. You know, just tie the guy up, stall. As you can't do that forever, and the guy on top is probably going to tire a lot slower than the guy on bottom. So you better figure out how to either get out of that position or at least to conserve some energy. But yeah, very, very interesting. The reason I asked about your training before was I find probably one of the biggest challenges I have when I'm talking to someone about really developing martial arts skills or the ability to manage high-end violence is a reluctance to actually train. And when I say train, I don't mean show up to class twice a week. I mean, like, train. Like, work on their fitness, work on their mindset, and train, you know, a couple of hours a day, at least in the early stages when you're developing those base level skills. As an instructor, how do you manage that? I mean, obviously people have lives, and most people are training because it's a hobby, not because they're expecting to get jumped by bikers in a bar. How do you manage that as an instructor?
Well, that's a question that to do its due diligence would require more time than we have, but I'll give you the condensed version. Once you're done with the physical, you want to work on the mental and the emotional, okay? I spend 50, 60, 70% of my time working on emotions throughout the day. And then eventually you work your way up to a spiritual. So training like that, when I train personally, I'm doing it because I want to feel better. Mm. And I enjoy training, okay? And furthermore, I enjoy getting hit and tapping, okay? It's like because I'm always going to try to get in with people better than me. I have no, you know, compunction getting in with, you know, 22-year-old MMA guys, and I know I've seen the story a million times, you know, so I see how long can I last, what can I get in, how hard are they going to hit, when I go to the ground, how well can I hold the posture, how many bites did I simulate throughout this whole encounter, how many times did I poke the ice, and in the process of figuring all that shit out, you get hit a tremendous amount of times, you get taken down, you know. So if you can't crave that, if you can't, because it's just at the end of the day, you're being vulnerable. And if, you know, and if you cannot be vulnerable, you have to put this facade on, then you're never going to get that emotional benefit. Okay. So after I'm done training, I get that emotional benefit. I feel like, so therefore, you know, I'm looking forward, you know, I'm 59. If I told you I'm better now as a fighter than when I was 29, you'd go, yeah, right. But there's no comparison almost on every metric. But it has to do with more emotion than it does physical.
Yeah, that's really interesting, and I think for someone like yourself, like see, you crave the battle, to steal a Dave Camarillo hashtag, to crave the battle. I mean, you have to make that adjustment. I mean, at some point, your athleticism is going to decline with age, but it doesn't mean that your mindset and your skills have to.
Well, I'll tell you an interesting thing that Bruce Lee said. Okay. And this was regarding the subject of aging. I had an audio cassette of him talking with Daniel Lee. And the question was about aging, or, you know, when I get to be this age, this was Bruce talking. And he said, here's what people don't understand. If you take the aging process and then get a microcosm, say one day, and say, how much did I lose through aging in this one day? And that is such an infinitesimal amount that it's almost unquantifiable, okay? Now, ask yourself the same question. How much did I grow in this one day? Now, this is provided, the only caveat is you have to train every day. You can't go 15 years without training. The formula is moot, okay? But now, so I train every day. How much did I learn? How much did I grow in one day? And the amount that you can, and here's the moral to my story, the amount that we can grow each day is so much higher, and I even mean physically, than the amount that we lose through aging. And I know this to be a fact because I've rolled with Elio Gracie in his 80s. He kicked my ass. Wow. I stick fought with Kakoi Kenyedi in his 80s. He kicked my ass. Hell, to this day, I roll with Dan, and he'll cheese out with me, pop, pop, pop on the chest. You're rusty. I'm like, Jesus, how is this happening? You know, so I've been destroyed from people in their 70s and 80s my whole life. So I know this to be a fact.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that's to me, like, that's what excites me about martial arts still. It's not about, you know, the other stuff is cool, but I think the ability to use it to, I guess, transcend the mortal boundaries of what we expect elderly people to be able to achieve, or what we expect to be able to do in our middle age, or, you know, like you come across these examples of people that just seem like they're from a different planet. And like you, I've had, you know, my first wrestling coach was in his, I think 60s, when I started training with him, and he was a Russian, so I mean, 60 is like, yeah, he probably hit his life expectancy already. But he threw me across the room, and he was like 40 kilos lighter than me, and in his 60s, and he threw me around like nothing. And I had a visiting judo sensei, the same story. Is he asked me to randori, and I was 21, so I'm a big guy, so I was like 21, 6'3", 260 pounds. And he was, I think, probably in his late 50s, and he was maybe 5'4" and about 150 pounds, maybe. And he asked me to randori, and obviously you don't turn him down, but I was like, oh, geez, I don't want to hurt this guy. Like, I don't want to be the guy that hurts the visiting instructor. And I had no such concerns. he was like fighting an empty jacket every time I thought I had something, he was gone, and then I was looking at the lights, and I had no idea what had just happened to me. And those are special moments when you come across those.
Yeah, and those rarely come when you go to class exactly at the right time, and you put your gi on the right way, and you get in line, and then you go home, and you do your perfunctory class twice a week. You know, you gotta get past that. My experience with most of my senior instructors, if you develop a relationship as a martial art instructor, that's a closer bond even than a regular friendship, you know, I can speak, you know, from both directions, a teacher and a student. And for me, to get the real stuff out of somebody, you got to get to know them. Okay. You got to know them. I can look in Hickson's eyes and I can tell when he's concerned about somebody. And then all of a sudden he takes that breath. I know that look. And I'm like, here we go. And, you know, and the same thing with Dan. It's just, you know them so well. And then you, why is it this way? And how? And until you get into the personality and the reasons of the fighter, all those techniques, oh my gosh, that's it's crazy. It's like people giving you techniques on how to swim, and you're doing all the strokes, and then somebody throws your ass in the water.
Yeah. I love that analogy because I'm often said that I try to learn how to fight from someone who's never been in a fight is like learning how to swim from someone who's never been in water. It just doesn't. They might have all the technique down right, but it's not going to help you very much when you're drowning.
You know, and the funny thing is, either have been in a fight, okay, or have been trained well by somebody who has.
Yeah.
Okay. Because yeah. You can take a student who's never been in a real street fight, and because the training, and this is exactly like Navy SEALs, exactly, it's an emblematic statement of SEALs. Because the training is so realistic and you're doing it, those Navy SEALs I work with that are 22 have never had real bullets fly over their head, most of them, but their training is so hardcore and so right that when the real thing happens, it doesn't matter. It really becomes moot. However, you have to have someone that's really been in fights, and you have to have a realistic training regimen. Otherwise, like you said so perfectly, it's the blind leading the blind.
Yeah, I think once that system is established, as long as no one messes with it, I think, the system can carry on despite the experience. But developing that system certainly requires that melting pot and that, I guess, that testing ground to see what works and what doesn't work. And as you mentioned, I mean, the ability to go, wow, I got my ass kicked doing that. Let's go back and unpack that, see what happened, to be able to ask a mentor, what did you do? How did that work? And that's there's so much value in mentorship. And I'm so glad you brought it up because it's not a topic we've talked about on the show before. And I'm very grateful that I actually work for my instructor. So my professional world and my martial arts world blend together. So that's it's a very nice environment for me to have to be able to pick my instructor's brain whenever I want to pick up the phone. And I just have to caveat the call and say, this isn't a work call. This is a martial arts call. I've been thinking about this. And just sort of make sure to switch his brain over to the right way.
Yep, I know exactly what you're talking about.
All right, Paul, I think, there is so much more we could talk about. But to end the regular portion of the interview, I'd just like to encourage everybody to check out all your material. You're prolific. You've written a lot of material. You've got so many DVDs and VHS tapes. Well, I've got your VHS tapes. I don't think they're still for sale. But
I heard that VHS. Are you a baby boomer?
I'm not. But I was right on the cusp.
Well, it's been a real pleasure and an honor. I'd love to do it anytime you want. You know, folks, you can go to voonak.com and check things out if you want. And anytime you want, you give me a ring and we'll do this again, buddy.
Thank you once again to Sifu Paul Voonak. Man, that is one off the bucket list for me. As I mentioned during the episode, Paul has been the soundtrack, one of the many names that has been the soundtrack to my martial arts and self-defense journey. And to be able to sit down and talk to him on the phone was just incredible. Man, I'm so blessed. I'm so blessed, and I'm so glad that I started this show because the conversations this enabled me to have are just tremendous. All right, if you'd like to hear more from Paul, he did contribute some bonus content. It's here on our Patreon at www.patreon.com/managingviolence. Sign up to be a tribal council or tribal elder, and you will get all the bonus content from season 4, 5, and now 6 as well. Certainly worth the investment if you ask me, but I would say that. So check it out for yourself. All right, that's it for this particular episode. We'll be back next week. Until then, I'll talk to you next time.